a complete fallacy to say that they don't target journalists. The issue is mainly that if any other country had committed acts of these massacres of journalists in the way that Israel does, any other country in the world would find themselves isolated on the world stage. They'd be subjected to sanctions, arms embargoes, trade embargoes. But instead, the opposite is happening. The killing of journalists is continuing, while the most powerful nations on the planet, including the United States and Britain, continue not only to give the political support, but the military support to enable these acts to be carried out. So they are equally as culpable for the deaths of Amal, for the deaths of Ali, Fatima and Mohammed. They're equally as culpable as Israel. They are the ones that load the gun while Israel pulls the trigger.
Steve Sweeney, just to be clear, on that day in March, I wanted to go to a short clip of what happened to you.
Further rocket attacks were reported against Nahariya and a minute.
So that's Steve Sweeney, Lebanon bureau chief for RT, the Russian news channel, Israeli airstrike right behind him. And I also wanted to ask you, Steve, about the Lebanese president weighing in the case of Amal. Aid workers tried to get to her. They had gotten to Zineb. She had a terrible head wound. But explain what happened, what a sound bomb and live ammunition. And the Lebanese president, Aoun, said that the Lebanese Red Cross should be able to save her after hours where they could not.
Well, yes, that's right. The statement from the Lebanese presidency and again, from the Prime Minister Nawaf Salam denouncing the attack as war crimes. President Aoun said, of course, that the civil defense workers, the emergency workers should be able to get to the journalists as they were trapped under the rubble. Now, there's been some criticism leveled at the pair of them, at Joseph Aoun and Nawaf Salam. And what people are saying is, well, there's the moment there's this discussion around sovereignty, there's these so-called peace talks and negotiations. But President Aoun had to effectively beg Israel to allow the emergency services to enter what is essentially Lebanese sovereign territory to rescue Lebanese citizens. So there's some criticism that have been leveled, that's been leveled at him by other journalists, by Amal's family as well, because, you know, she lay under that rubble for 7 hours whilst the emergency services were blocked from entering. They were attacked, yes, with sound bombs, with live ammunition. Even when Zeynep Faraj was when she was rescued, when she was being taken to the hospital, that ambulance came under fire. You can see, and you can find these images on social media if you don't have them, but there are bullet holes in the ambulance that took her to hospital. Now, this is nothing new. The attacks on emergency workers are nothing new. This is something that's been happening fairly consistently in the particularly in the south of Lebanon since the Israeli escalation on March the 2nd. There's been nearly 2,500 people killed, and around 100 of those are emergency workers. Now, we've seen in that period, they called it a ceasefire. But during that time, it's really just, and this announcement of the 3 additional weeks by Donald Trump, essentially, it's an extension allowing Israel to carry out more war crimes in the south. They've created this so-called yellow zone, which is, you know, the Gaza-style yellow zone, which means 55 settlements, border towns, villages are effectively cut off. The local people, the people that live there, are not being allowed to return. Their homes are being detonated. Entire settlements have been completely destroyed. Hospitals have been destroyed. Ambulances have been set on fire. Steve, schools have been detonated.
Steve, we have to break, but I wanted to go back to Sarakuda. To finally ask you about another story the Committee to Protect Journalists has been closely following. A court in Kuwait has just acquitted the U.S. Kuwaiti journalist Ahmed Shahab Eldin on charges of spreading false information harming national security after he posted about the U.S.-Israeli war in Iran on social media. He's expected to walk free from a Kuwaiti prison today, capping 52 days behind bars, posting video that others posted, including the national networks here in the United States. Can you explain what happened and what he faced and what you think will happen today?
Thank you, Amy. It's very difficult to move from a very tragic and sad story to another good one. Finally, Ahmed Shihab Eldin has been acquitted from the charges against him. And at CPJ, we are so relieved for this information. We do not have a lot of information from his international legal team on what will happen and what's going to happen today or the coming days. But we have known, it is known that he has been fully acquitted from all charges against him. Ahmed Shihab Eldin was visiting his family during the Iran war, and it is known that since March 2nd, he stopped posting or appearing in public. It was known also that on March 3rd, he was arrested because he reposted on his social media accounts a video that was taken and verified by other international media outlets, and he just reposted this video. He was arrested because of that, and of course, one of the charges on him was anti-state charges, because the Kuwait, just like other Gulf countries, they forbidden any kind of media footages, the videography, or reporting on what was happening during the Iran war in the Gulf.
You have talked about his arrest. The CPJ has, as part of a much wider crackdown on online journalism and free expression in Gulf nations, Sarah.
That's true, because since the war started, from day number one, since the Iran war started late February this year, almost every single Gulf country has put out new rules and new laws that are restricting freedom of expression. They banned taking photographs or publishing anything or even speaking in a very casual way, not in a journalistic manner, about what is happening. And those are very concerning, because we are talking about countries that already have a tight grip on the press and freedom of expression. So when they even tighten this more and put out more laws that are restricting journalists and freedom of expression and citizen journalists, we are talking about a severe decline in freedom of expression in countries that the people, the citizens, are in much need for verified information to know what is happening around them. So we are also depriving the information consumers from their right to know what is happening.
Sarah Kuda, I want to thank you for being with us, Middle East and North Africa Regional Director at the Committee to Protect Journalists. And I want to thank Steve Sweeney, the Lebanon Bureau Chief for RT. He was speaking to us from Beirut, she from Paris. Coming up, New York City Council Member Chiosse. He was violently arrested earlier this week at a protest against deed theft, a practice that has led to many evictions of longtime homeowners. Stay with us.
History's not made by presidents or popes or kings or queens or generals or CIA kingpins running dope. History's not made by nine-robed men or billionaires or bankers. It's not made by them.
Tom Morello performing Black Spartacus. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez. Four people were arrested Wednesday in the Bed-Stuy neighborhood in Brooklyn after gathering in support of Carmela Charrington, a resident fighting eviction from her longtime family home. Supporters gathered in front of a brownstone on Jefferson Avenue as marshals arrived to carry out the eviction. When they couldn't get through, police were called. Brooklyn councilmember Chiose was among those police arrested. He was wrestled to the ground and handcuffed as protesters chanted, "Who do you serve? Who do you protect?" Carmela Charrington and local housing advocates say the sale of her property to investors in 2024 was a form of deed theft, a criminal practice where predatory speculators use forgery, deceit, or fraud to illegally transfer ownership on paper and sell properties without the knowledge or full understanding of rightful owners. Bedford-Stuyvesant is a rapidly gentrifying, historically Black neighborhood where elderly homeowners are often targeted by speculators. From 2014 to 2023, officials reported 1,500 complaints of deed theft in Brooklyn alone. The new owners of the Brownstone, 227 Group LLC, call the allegations of deed theft unequivocally false, pointing to the decisions of two New York State judges and the conclusion of the Attorney General's office, which called it a complex property dispute rather than deed theft. But advocates for Ms. Charrington, including New York City Councilmember Ose, say residents should not be evicted until all legal avenues have been exhausted. He's calling for a moratorium on evictions in cases where deed theft is suspected. Just this morning, Mayor Zoran Mamdani established the Office of Deed Theft Prevention, saying, quote, "The theft of a home is the theft of a family's future." For more, we are joined by New York City Councilmember Chiose in New York. Thanks so much for being with us. Can you start off by talking about why you were arrested and why you were there in Bed-Stuy this week?
Well, first and foremost, good morning, Amy. Thank you so much for having me on. When I got a call from my constituent, Ms. Charrington, she called in panic. Their marshals were at her door. She's a grandmother. There is a 7-month child that was in the house. As a council member and also as a human being, I found it to be my responsibility to show up and see how I could support, at least delay the eviction of her and her family. When I arrived on the scene, there were marshals, there were police officers, a crowd began to grow, more officers arrived at the scene. I tried to talk to the marshal to see if we could buy some time, engaged in multiple conversations with Ms. Charrington and her lawyer to see if we could present a stay on evictions. When the marshal started moving in my soul, I could not let that take place. I could not see a family, a Black family within Bed-Stuy, removed from a home. So I stood in front of the house. The marshal, several officers, approached me, attempted to arrest me, body slammed me on the ground, cuffed me, and brought me into a police vehicle, which drove me to the local precinct.
And Councilman, could you talk about this whole issue of deed theft and the role of conservators and this particular group, 227 Group LLC, which has bought so far 119 properties in Black and Latino neighborhoods?
Absolutely. So as we see neighborhoods like Bed-Stuy, Southeast Queens, Harlem become more desirable in the eyes of real estate companies and real estate brokers, we're seeing a rise in deed theft across our communities. Deed theft is basically the practice of stealing one's home through paper, using fraudulent schemes of forging signatures, or using even family members as a means to steal or occupy one's home to then sell it for millions of dollars. Again, as these properties are becoming more expensive, as more folks, white folks, are moving into these neighborhoods, these homes are seen as more desirable and lucrative for these real estate institutions. And that's why deed theft has been rising. That's why communities like mine have not only been seeing rampant displacement and gentrification, but also an attack on homeowners to force them out of their homes.
And could you talk as well about a particular Brooklyn attorney, 68-year-old Sanford Solney, who was convicted last year of 13 counts of third-degree criminal possession of stolen property? He was sentenced to 2.5 years in prison for stealing 11 deeds. What's the significance of his case?
Well, first and foremost, 2.5 years is not nearly enough that someone should be convicted for stealing multiple homes within New York City or anywhere for that fact. He is just one of the many examples of those who are participating in deed theft. There have only been, you know, a couple folks who have been held accountable and been brought to justice, but there are more deed thieves who are out there. Many of these schemes are complicated and complex, which is why some of these cases take so long to process and why some of these individuals and deed thieves who are participating in deed theft are not brought to justice for some time. He is just one of the many who we are advocating to lock up. You know, these are individuals who are participating in violent evictions of homeowners, and we saw an example of that taking place a couple days ago.
And Chiyose, your response to Mayor Zoran Mamdani today establishing the Office of Deed Theft Prevention, saying, quote, the theft of a home is the theft of a family's future. What exactly will this mean? What kind of resources are going to be put into this office?
Absolutely. So before I endorsed Zoran as mayor last year, I had a conversation with him and his team, multiple conversations with him and his team about how important deed theft was to me and my constituency. He made a pledge on the campaign trail to make an investment in opening a mayor's office to prevent deed theft. And today he's fulfilling that promise. And we've been working with his office over the past couple of weeks of what this office would look like. Generally, it will circumvent communication between the various different city agencies through the state attorney general's office, as well as different district attorney's offices, and making sure that we're not only preventing deed theft and doing educational campaigns for homeowners alike who are worried about how they could be victims of deed theft, but we'll also be providing them with resources on how to defend against deed theft, looking into how we could hire experienced attorneys who could fight back against these cases. A lot of the cases that we see when it comes to deed theft and when victims come to our office, there's a passing of the buck of who's responsible for holding these deed thieves accountable. This office will circumvent all of that communication and making sure that we are addressing the root cause of this problem and identifying who can truly enforce and prevent deed theft from taking place within our communities.
Chiyose, I want to thank you for being with us. New York City council member arrested this week as he tried to stop the displacement of a woman in Bed-Stuy from her home. Thank you. Coming up, Muskism, a guide for the perplexed. Professor Quinn Slobodian looks at the ideology of Elon Musk.
To the misanthropic, misbegotten merchants of gloom, who look into their crystal balls and prophesy our doom, let the death knell chime. It's the end of time. Let the cynics put their blinkers on and toast our decline. Don't become demoralized by this chorus of complaint. It's a sure sign that the old world is terminally quaint and tomorrow's gonna be a better day. No matter what the siren voices say, tomorrow's gonna be a better day. We're gonna make it that way. Yeah. It's kind of ironic whistling for something, for the melody. Yeah.
Billy Bragg singing Tomorrow's Gonna Be a Better Day in our Democracy Now! Studio back in New York. I'm Amy Goodman in Seattle for the opening of the film about Democracy Now! Steal This Story, Please. Juan Gonzalez is in Chicago, where we'll be headed soon. We end today's show with a look at the ideology and influence of Elon Musk, the richest person in the world with a fortune estimated by Forbes at $800 billion. Musk runs rocket company SpaceX, AI startup XAI, electric car maker Tesla, and the social media platform X, formerly Twitter. His political influence extends from using his massive platform to advance controversial ideas, his political donations, as well as his role leading the so-called Department of Government Efficiency, or DOGE, a quasi-governmental agency that oversaw chaotic layoffs and cutbacks across government agencies. In the new book, Muskism, A Guide for the Perplexed, authors Quinn Slobodian and Ben Tarnoff look at the worldview that shaped Musk and the ideology that's coalesced around him. They call it Muskism, an operating system for the 21st century. In a review of the book, prominent science fiction writer and journalist Cory Doctorow wrote in a review, quote, Muskism doesn't see to exit the state. It seeks to colonize and control it. For more, we're joined in New York by Quinn Slobodian, professor of international history at Boston University, co-author with Ben Tarnoff of Muskism. Thank you so much for being with us. If you can talk about the latest news right now and the empire that Musk has acquired. There's been a lot of news about space in the last few weeks, and particularly start off by talking about SpaceX and what he's doing.
Yeah, SpaceX is kind of a tough wake-up call for people who have this impression that Musk had disappeared from the news, had had some kind of feud with Trump, and everything had now passed into the rearview mirror. In fact, we're gearing up for what is going to be likely the largest IPO in history, with SpaceX likely in June, projected to be somewhere between $1.5 trillion and $2 trillion valuation, which will put it immediately as one of the top 10 biggest companies in the United States, potentially more valuable than Meta. And that's interesting because SpaceX itself has now become a kind of a merger of many of Musk's ventures. XAI, the AI company that was mentioned, is now part of SpaceX. X.com itself is now part of SpaceX itself, too. So he's not just building a kind of a rocket company or a satellite company, but what we see is a vertically integrated ideological stack where he can kind of build an echo chamber from low Earth orbit all the way back to Earth and create a kind of closed loop for the ideology that he wants to push out.
And Quinn Slobodian, could you talk some about his about Musk's childhood, his being raised in South Africa, from and the deep commitment that he has to racial hierarchy, industrial self-reliance, and what you call fortress futurism?
Yeah, so what we try to work out in the book is where he gets this idea of the state as a kind of technologically enabled fortress that needs to be constantly reinforced and buttressed against external enemies and internal enemies. It turns out that late apartheid South Africa is kind of a perfect prototype for this version of organizing society and economic forces. In late apartheid South Africa, we think of it naturally as a very backward place politically, explicitly engineered to reinforce racial hierarchies, but they were also a very high-tech country. They're importing nuclear technology from the United States and Israel. They built out their own bomb. They were using IBM mainframes to actually sort out populations and conduct the very practice of apartheid. They built out their own auto industry inside of South Africa. So it became a kind of enclosed enclave economy, which was nevertheless still plugged in to a global economic marketplace. And this is what Musk has been able to sell to, a vision of a kind of civilizationally hierarchical, technologically enabled, enclave approach to the world in which states and then households, too, are sold products to protect them in a time of civilizational breakdown. And Musk then ideologically is incentivized to push more and more fears and anxieties out there to therefore produce more of a demand for the products he will sell to you to harden yourself against the coming unrest, the coming storm that he predicts is around the corner.
And yet you have this contradiction that on the one hand, Musk companies depend so much on government support or subsidies, and yet he is trying to deconstruct a government at the same time.
Yeah, I mean, this was really the incentive for us to write the book, is we feel like we needed a kind of a new narrative for this new era that had been entered into with big tech and digital capitalism. For a while now, we've been talking about libertarianism and even cyber libertarianism as if this is the main way to understand Silicon Valley, that it's about Ayn Rand, it's about visions of colonizing Mars. But in fact, at least since the rollout of ChatGPT in 2022, the big tech companies now realize they need a much closer relationship to the state than they had before. If you're going to build out the kind of data centers that they are building out, if you're going to have federal land opened up to new construction, in order sources of water, new sources of energy. You can't just do the kind of asset-light version of social media-style platform capitalism that they did for many years in the time of Web 2.0. You need to fuse with the state. And someone like Peter Thiel, you know, pioneered this when he made his alliance with Trump in 2016 already. But now, as we know, the rest of the Silicon Valley leadership class has followed behind, literally standing and sitting behind Trump at the inauguration. So any vision that this is libertarian, I think, is now not helpful. It's a period of what we call state symbiosis, a period of selling sovereignty as a service. And as we know most recently by the Palantir Manifesto and the fast tracking of Project Maven into the military software and technology of warfighting in the United States, it's a time when the fates of the state and the fates of these companies is now extremely wound up with one another. And we need to sort of understand that dependency that's been produced, because SpaceX, too, will be fast-tracked into the indexes so that people's pension funds, college retirement funds, all of these sort of things are now going to be part and parcel of often the quite vicious and xenophobic visions of the founder CEOs like Elon Musk.
This is Elon Musk talking about an imagined future built on AI and robotics in which there's no money and everyone could get a free trip to Saturn.
It's really the only path to amazing abundance is AI and robotics. Now, wouldn't it be amazing if you could buy a trip to Saturn? Or frankly, if you just have a trip to Saturn, I think things will just be free in the future. It sounds nuts, but you know, if you've got an AI robotics economy that is anywhere close to a million times the size of the current Earth economy, literally any need you possibly want can be met. If you can think of it, you can have it. So I think Ian Banks, in his culture books, has it pretty much right, where there actually isn't money in the future, and there's abundance for everyone. If you can think of it, you can have it.
So in your final comments, Professor Slobodian, if you can talk about what he's saying and the changing goals of SpaceX from colonizing Mars to orbital AI data centers.
Yeah, I mean, it almost has to make you laugh to hear these kind of low-energy efforts he makes that seem to be just sort of free-associating what he hopes will be enough of a distraction that people won't actually look, A, what his empire is being built on, and B, what day-to-day he pushes out on his platform X, which has now really become a megaphone for a far-right international. I mean, he's talking there about endless abundance and travel to Saturn, but what he talks about from day-to-day on X is the need for remigration, the danger of racialized immigration, the dangers of falling white birth rates. Palantir's manifesto talks about cultural hierarchies. So one has to look more at the day-to-day production of what they're doing, but more importantly, as you suggest, what the products are that they're actually building. So SpaceX now, its valuation is based on this idea that he's going to be able to put AI data centers in space, totally untested technology, but also that he'll be able to ramp up something called Starlink Mobile so that he'll be able to provide direct-to-device and direct-to-laptop internet and connectivity for, you know, perhaps the entire planet, at which point he's able to kind of keep the legacy media, as he calls it, keep independent media sources like Democracy Now! Out of the conversation and produce a kind of hermetically closed loop in which people are forced to then ingest the ridiculous things that he says on stage, like the kind that we just saw.
Quinn Slobodian, professor of international history at Boston University, co-author of Muskism, A Guide for the Perplexed. That does it for today's show. I'll be appearing at several theatrical openings in the new documentary about Democracy Now! Steal the Story, Please! Tonight in Seattle, tomorrow at two screenings in Portland, Oregon, then back to the IFC Center in New York. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez.
You are now listening to CJSF 90.1 FM, broadcasting from Burnaby, BC.
With 1.5 million Canadians identifying as blind or having low vision, what will the future look like as we move to a world where using our eyes for screen time is at an all-time high? The BC Yukon Division of the Canadian Council of the Blind, or CCB, is a group run by the blind for the blind, where sports and recreation, technology training, and peer support are just a few of what they offer. To find out more, visit ccbbcyukon.com.